Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest.
Welcome back to another Books with Hooks. Carly, we're throwing it across to you.
Well, I want to let everybody know we are in season 20. Did you guys know there are 20 seasons, well, 19, 20 coming up of our show? If you have not listened to the back catalog, I will say, and I'm not just saying that because it's me and Cece who give the advice and Bianca who give the advice, but the advice, it stays the same, you know what I mean, over 3 years of doing this. So if you are truly looking for a deep well of information, we love that you guys listen every week, but there are tons and tons of great gems in the back catalog, 19 seasons of gems to go back and listen to. So we really hope that in your education of writing and publishing that you will go back and consume all of that great content. And a reminder, this is an unscripted program and all of our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer to our written notes for the fulsome picture. And here are all the ways that you could support us as a show. Rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcast or wherever you consume our show. Tell your writing friends about us. We love to help as many writers as humanly possible. And of course, follow us on our Substack newsletter. This is where you can get tons of information on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. And if you become a paid subscriber, you get all of our written notes. Cece and I, we carefully detail everything that we talk about on the show in our notes. And if you are a paid Substack subscriber, you have access to our exact notes. And that is it for me today.
Thank you, Carly. And for our listeners, please don't forget to send us all of your good news. I'm hearing excellent good news from people's critique partners in their beta groups. I don't know if you're all too shy to reach out and boast or share your wonderful news with us, but please don't be. We want to celebrate with you. So email the podcast. There is a tab on our website that says share your great news, and we'd love to share it with the rest of our listeners to motivate them along the way. Okay, as per usual, we're diving straight in. Cece, will you read us your query letter?
Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, I have learned so much from listening to The Shit No One Tells You About Writing and hope that you will consider and provide feedback on my query letter and first 5 pages of my novel. I am seeking representation for my 60,000-word debut book club-type novel, One Boy's Life. Although a mainstream novel, if heartwarming were a genre, that would certainly fit. It would appeal to fans of Jan Caron's Mitford series from the early 2000s. More recent comparisons might be to the community spirit found in Louise Penny's Inspector Gamache series, or the family relationships in Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. Mid-30s widow Beth Anderson has an encounter with Mike, a 12-year-old boy, and eventually his faithful dog Homer. The boy is a true orphan, determined to make it on his own after the death of his mother a few months before. Taking Mike and Homer under her wing, the threesome navigate a number of challenges, including bureaucratic agencies, an attempted kidnapping, a home invasion, and a custody battle. In the midst of all this, Beth discovers Mike's and his mother's true identities and meets Bill Swanson, a longtime DEA agent. Beth, Bill, Mike, and Homer eventually create a loving family of their own. I am a new novelist, a retired bureaucrat from Argonne National Laboratory. Like Beth, I am a widow. However, I have 2 children. I have been writing for about 6 years and have 2 other books in the works, a thriller and a nonfiction biography. I am a born Midwestern, having spent all my life in Wisconsin and Illinois, but enjoying many opportunities for international and U.S. travel. I am, as a friend in my writing workshop says, so Midwestern. I have an undergraduate degree in speech and English from the University of Wisconsin, Whitewater, and a master's of business administration degree in technology management from Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago, Illinois. I am enclosing the first 5 pages of my story in hopes that you would be willing to consider my entire manuscript. To view additional samples of my writing, you can view my website at marylynslife.com. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to hearing from you. Respectfully, Mary Lynn Alder Hodshire.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, can you give us an indication of word count and your take on that?
So in terms of word count, this one came in at 374 words. I actually will start with my word count note, which is your author paragraph is 115 words long, not including the last paragraph that starts with, I am enclosing the first 5 pages. That's pretty long too. So I would cut that because it's longer than the plot paragraph. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, your plot paragraph is shorter than 115 words. And I really like your author paragraph. I'm so excited for all these amazing things that you have to share, but they are not all relevant at the query letter stage. Your agent will want to know about them when you have a call with them, but we're not there yet. So I would just keep it short and simple. You know, really 2 lines is all you need, 3 at the most. You can really condense. And that way you can use the extra space for the plot paragraph because you need the extra space there. So I feel like today I'm going in reverse order. So let's move up to the plot paragraph. What's missing here for me is causality. We have the line that reads, you know, they're navigating a number of challenges. And then we have bureaucratic agencies, attempted kidnapping, home invasion, custody battle. I don't see how they all come together with cause and effect. You know, usually it's better to have this one thing led to this other thing, which led to this other thing, which then escalated into this. You really want those dominoes tipping over that Bianca's always talking about. It's really important to just ensure that there's proper tension and to promise to an agent that the plot is crafted in a way that reads like a fulsome story. And right now we don't have that here, so I would tweak that. Especially because I'm guessing that these things are connected. Like, I'm guessing that the attempted kidnapping is connected to the home invasion, but I don't know. You're also giving away the ending, I feel, right? Like with the line that reads, Beth, Bill, Mike, and Homer eventually create a loving family. And I'm like, I don't think we need to know the happy ending. Like, I'm glad that it's there, but we don't need to know the happy ending at this point. So don't reveal all your goods. You know, a small note still in that paragraph, he's referred to as a true orphan, the boy. And like, I don't think you need the word true. because he's an orphan, right? Like, as opposed to what? An imaginary orphan, or like maybe just an orphan of one parent. But like, you just don't need that word. I feel like it tripped me up. Okay, now we're going up to the first paragraph. 60,000 words concerns me because it's very short. Now, it's not that I don't like short novels. Short novels are great. Lots of people love short novels. But if it's book club, you're telling me that you're going to have really meaty subjects that readers can sink their teeth into and really get a conversation started and debate about things. And I don't know that you can do that in 60,000 words. Like, maybe you can. Maybe you'll be amazing and you'll prove me wrong. But, you know, it does make me think, are you using all the words that you can? You italicized book club type, and you don't need to do that. Just, you know, if it's book club fiction, write that it's book club fiction. I don't think you need the line that reads, although a mainstream novel, if heartwarming were a genre, that would fit. Again, taking up space, you're not telling me anything. Query letter, you know, really make sure that your query letter is tight and meaty. Like, every single sentence should be doing something really important because you don't get a lot of sentences. And I also would not highlight the fact that your comps aren't recent. At least your first comp isn't. You know, you start the sentence with, more recent comps might be. Like, don't do that because you're calling attention to the fact that you used old comps. So I would work on that because the comps right now are a little confusing to me. They seem to be really different. And so I'm not quite sure where your book fits in the comps universe. So maybe you need to rethink your comps, or maybe it's just how you're framing them. I'm not sure. I'd have to talk to you to know for sure. But I will say, you know, a story where a woman has a clear disruption in her life, this boy enters, like, a clear disruption can be a very compelling way to get a story started. And clearly you have plot. So I just think it's about framing it.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, your thoughts?
I agree with everything Cece said, so I won't double down on that, but I did want to verbalize that I agree with everything Cece said. I want to focus on two things. Number one is the nefariousness of this book. I guess I just question, like, the line that says, Beth has an encounter with a 12-year-old boy. What does an encounter mean? I mean, like, I just think you're asking the reader to make a lot of assumptions about what this encounter is. And maybe I've been, you know, reading too much about the film awards circuit lately about, like, May December and Poor Things and stuff like that. I don't know if encounter is the right word here. I'm a little bit concerned about what it means and her intentions, obviously, with taking him in. And I don't know. There's a lot of question marks for me. You also, after you use the word encounter, two lines later, you use the word threesome. There are obviously sexual connotations when you use that word. And so I just, again, have a lot of question marks about this. And maybe it's intentional. Maybe it's not intentional. My job is just to flag this for you and how this comes off, especially within a couple lines of each other. So I want to flag that. The second thing I want to flag is I think you're missing a huge comp here, which is one of my clients' books, which is Where the Forest Meets the Stars by Glendi Vandera. And I will read you the jacket copy so you can kind of get a sense of what happens in this book. But I will tell you, essentially, we have our main character, female protagonist. She's a scientist and she's working out in the woods, and like a small child comes and knocks on her door and they form this like super unlikely friendship. And then there's another character that comes in. So I think this is a very clear comp for you. I'm going to read it to you because this is an example of something where there is a lot of drama and thriller-ness that happens in Where the Forest Meets the Stars, which I think you're kind of getting at with this whole like DEA thing and the attempted kidnapping. So I'll read it for you. So this book, Glendi's book, Where the Forest Meets the Stars, was a Goodreads Choice finalist for the year it came out. It sold 800,000 copies, like almost a million copies. It sold a lot of books, right? So I think what you're getting at here is super interesting, but I just don't think you're framing it well. So I want to read you Glendi's jacket copy. And jacket copy is jacket copy. It is not pitch copy in the sense of you need to copy this or anything, but I just want to give you a sense of how a book like this could be framed. In this gorgeously stunning debut, a mysterious child teaches two strangers how to love and trust again. After the loss of her mother and her own battle with breast cancer, Joanna Teal returns to her graduate research on nesting birds in rural Illinois, determined to prove that her recent hardships have not broken her. She throws herself into her work from dusk till dawn until her solitary routine is disrupted by the appearance of a mysterious child who shows up at her cabin barefoot and covered in bruises. The girl calls herself Ursa. She claimed to have been sent from the stars to witness five miracles. With concerns about the child's home situation, Jo reluctantly agrees to let her stay just until she learns more about Ursa's past. Jo enlists the help of a reclusive neighbor, Gabriel Nash, to solve the mystery of the charming child. But the more time they spend together, the more questions they have. How does a young girl not only read but understand Shakespeare? Why do good things keep happening in her presence? And why aren't Jo and Gabe checking the missing children's website anymore? Though the three have formed an incredible bond, they know the difficult choices must be made. As the summer nears an end and Ursa gets closer to her fifth miracle, her dangerous past closes in. when it finally catches up to them, all their painful secrets will be forced into the open and their fates will be left to the stars. So I think this is something where you can see the similarities. I think you can, again, use this as a bit of a help with your framing to kind of get at the fact that there is drama and tension. There is a very like hopeful energy to it. And I hope that that will help you, you know, just kind of hone in on what you need to get the job done here.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, what was in those opening pages?
All right, so the summary goes as follows. So Beth is driving back from the grocery store when she sees a young boy hitchhiking. And she wouldn't stop for an adult, but he's a kid, so she does. He gets in and he says he needs to go to the video store to sell video games to buy dog food because he's all alone and his dog is hungry and he's hungry. And that's the only way that he can feed himself and his dog. And so they start talking and Beth asks him questions. And we learn that, you know, he's living by himself. He has no electricity. He's an orphan. So Beth offers to bring him home so he can help her unload groceries, make some money, and she'll make him a sandwich. They go pick up his dog and they do that. And, you know, after he's eaten, or well, he and the dog, she asks him if he wants to stay over for a little while. And he says yes.
Great. Thank you. Okay. What was your take on that?
So I feel like for this week, I'm going to start with my big picture note because it informs everything else. My question is, and this is a question that every single writer should ask of themselves, in my opinion, who is your protagonist? Who is your protagonist? Your protagonist is, very clearly, according to the query letter, Beth. This boy is important. This boy is essential to the story. He's connected to the inciting incident. He's obviously going to affect her life. We're supposed to feel all sorts of feels for him. But your protagonist is Beth, right? This is her story, her point of view, her perspective, her interiority, her psyche that we're diving into. And yet, we are getting nothing from Beth's interiority. And I really wanted to, because she's meeting this boy. This boy's hitchhiking. And I get anxiety if I even think about a child hitchhiking, because I'm like, oh my God, that's so dangerous, right? And we are not getting interiority. That's who we should know the most about after reading these pages. We need to see Beth's specific associations, specific interiority with everything that happens. Most obvious example, a boy is hitchhiking. She just saw a kid hitchhiking. What emotionality is she feeling? We need emotionality there. When he climbs in the passenger seat, right? We need to know exactly what she's thinking. For example, if he does look like he's 13, I would be thinking of my goddaughter most likely. Or maybe I would be thinking of myself at 13 and how hitchhiking would have terrified me. Maybe I would be thinking of something else. You know, each person would be thinking about a specific person in their lives, including themselves at that age, something else. But that specificity in thoughts is what's going to develop her character. When they are talking, what is she thinking specifically? Because he's just giving her all the information. He's just laying it all out there. Is she thinking, why is this child so trusting? Did no one ever tell them not to talk to strangers? Probably not, because no one ever told him not to hitchhike. Unless they did tell him and he's just breaking the rules because he's that desperate or because for some other reason. She needs to be making assumptions. She needs to be forming theories. She needs to be adjusting those theories because they have to be wrong as she learns new information. We really need to see her psyche process information. Like, this is really, really important. Still connected to my big picture note, but moving on to dialogue. The dialogue here is really intense. She's talking to a kid who is selling his video games to buy food for his dog and for himself. They're out of food. He's an orphan. This is an incredibly intense scene. And she needs to be feeling things that are compatible with the person that she is. And different people would feel different things. I am sure that most humans in the situation would feel certain universal emotions like concern, anxiety. But how exactly does the calibration work in her? Like, if it were me, again, I have to think of myself because I'm only inside my own head. I would be spiking with anxiety, but I would be keeping it together because I would not want to spook this child, right? And there is a line that actually hints to the fact that she is doing just that. There's a line that reads, she played along, trying to figure out options to get this kid some sort of help. But notice how generic that is, you know? Why is she playing along specifically? What sort of options are going through her mind specifically? I think that's my other note here, which is its reading is very generic, which is something that you can fix, right? It's about diving into this person's psyche and really, really, really fleshing her out as a character. I worry that the dialogue didn't seem realistic. I'm not sure I believe that a child would walk into a car and just share all these things. It felt like it was happening for the benefit of the reader, so the reader would know what's going on with this child. But the problem is that I didn't really believe it. Like, I didn't buy it. And I have to buy it if I'm going to keep on reading it. And it could be a me problem, but I struggled with that. And, you know, as a small note, but since it connects to interiority, I'm just going to say it. The query letter says she's in her mid-30s, right? And when she's talking to the boy, after she invites him over, he says, okay, you don't look like some pervert anyway. You look more like somebody's grandma. So if I'm 35, and I'm guessing mid-30s, that's what it means. It could mean something else, I guess. And someone tells me I look like a grandma, I'm going to have a very specific reaction in my head. I'm going to go like, what the heck? Like, does this happen often to her? Do people often say she looks older? Is this the first time? Is she wondering how old was this kid's mom? If he thinks that she is a grandma, like, does that mean his mom was a teenage mom or a really, really young mom? Because I don't think kids can tell 35 to 25, you know, like they all look the same. They're all adults. And so if she is someone who looks way older than her, then I want her interiority to reflect that. Oh, story of my life. People are always thinking I'm older. When I was younger, I used to like it. Now I hate it. I don't know. I don't know what her interiority would be because you know your character, not me. But make sure that we're really in her head. And this actually ties to my word count note in the query letter I shared to you. I don't know that you can develop a character in 60,000 words. Right now, you need more words to develop your character, in my opinion. And the good news is you have the space to do it. So I'm very intrigued by the inciting incident. I just really, for me, plot-wise, this has the elements of a compelling scene. But in order for it to stand out in the competitive market, it needs more interiority, more emotionality to develop her character, the dialogue that's more realistic, and just more tension.
I really like that the author does have 20,000 or more words to expand on this. It's always so much harder when you're at that cap and people are like, we need more. And you're like, well, where the hell do you want me to put it? But with 20,000 words, you do have space here to play around. Carly?
Again, I agree with everything that Cece said. A couple of things that went through my mind was either this section of the book actually was much farther into the novel and the author like cut a bunch, maybe like 10, 20 pages to get here to be like, oh, this book should start here. So we missed a bunch of interiority. I'm kind of wondering if that happened. Or I think, yeah, there's just tons and tons of room for building on this interiority that is completely missing here, right? Like, we have no gut reaction, sadness, fear, like absolutely nothing, right? Because I don't know. I just felt like there was so much trust, again, with like what Cece said, right? Like, why are these two people trusting each other so soon? Trust is something you earn. And obviously, you can have sympathy for somebody, but sympathy doesn't equal trust, right? So I definitely have a lot of question marks there. Like, even, for example, where she says she made a U-turn, made their way back to the driveway. Mike hopped out and shouted over his shoulder, I'll be right back. In about 60 seconds, he and a medium-sized brown mutt of undetermined parentage came bounding towards the car. But she had 60 seconds to think. In those 60 seconds, we just hear 60 seconds pass. Like, to me, that was just the perfect time to kind of delve into, what am I getting myself into? I'm supposed to be at work in 20 minutes. Like, how on earth did this happen? I just feel like she needs to be somewhere. And the fact this happened to her, this kind of like kismet, maybe they were, again, she was meant to find him. It has to get in the way of something. And currently it's like, I think it's just like a Saturday morning. And she's like, well, there goes my Saturday. It's like, well, no, it should be like, I'm supposed to be at a meeting in an hour. How am I going to take care of this kid? You know, like that's the type of intensity. And it is a very intense scene, but we have to kind of set some stakes around this opening scene as well. I think the drama of it just isn't quite enough. And it takes until page 6 of 7 to get to like her kind of feeling like she says, what am I doing with a young preteen lonely kid? That's quite a bit in to kind of get that first bit of what I think is like that true interiority. So yeah, I mean, as I said, this setup has tons of potential. Like obviously, you know, I represented a book with a similar-ish premise, you know, where the forest meets the stars. So I get this. I think it's appealing. I just have tons of question marks still.
Thank you, Carly. Yeah, you know, for the author, in terms of character arc, if you start off with the characters immediately trusting each other, it doesn't give you a lot of room for maneuver in terms of them building this dynamic together and in terms of their relationship changing. So if you begin with distrust, and like Carly says, perhaps she's late for a super important interview and she's like, I need to be at this interview. Why am I spending time with this kid? And this kid is really distrustful of her. That allows us to shift somewhere in terms of that character arc. So definitely something to think about. And I feel your pain because I always start sort of in the wrong place. And then I backtrack and my first chapter becomes chapter 15. So something to consider there. Okay, Carly, can we hear your first query letter?
D, Dear Carly, I'm excited to present Redacted, my adult BIPOC steminist rom-com inspired by Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, complete at 75,000 words. This novel interweaves romance and academia like The Love Hypothesis and Honey and Spice, and will appeal to readers who also enjoy endearing sisterly bonds. As a top honors graduate pursuing her master's, Renike Bello doesn't believe in romantic relationships, unlike her sister, who fully embraces them. Her dream is simple: earn a PhD from Johns Hopkins, work her way to becoming a Nobel Prize winner. But her well-laid plan takes an unexpected turn when, in an effort to help her sister chase a campus crush, she enrolls in an analytics class only to fail the first exam. She soon realizes that while she might be killing it in market research, the analytical aspects want her dead. Like any other overachieving Nigerian child with parents paying thousands for her to study abroad, she panics and asks her professor for a tutor. The tutor is none other than Rotimi Jacobs, the annoyingly attractive baseball player, analytics whiz, and notorious snob, which is why Renike is positive that their tutor-tutee relationship will inevitably lead to an error. But when her failing grade threatens her assistantship, the only way of her paying rent and her GPA, a crucial variable for her admittance to Johns Hopkins, she reluctantly accepts Rotimi as her tutor. What begins as a one-sided rivalry transforms into late-night drives, restaurant hopping, and bonding over classics. As she learns to open her heart, she realizes that the matters of the heart are far more complex than any analytics test. Like my main character, I'm a graduate student from Nigeria based and studying marketing intelligence in the U.S., and ELCA certified screenwriter and the author of an indie published YA thriller. Thank you for your time and consideration. Redacted.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, what's our word count there and what's your take on that?
All right, it clocks in at 311 words. Okay, so I'll start at the top here. You know, the inspired by Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I feel like I get this comp all the time. And I feel like even 10 years ago, there were a bunch of kind of like Pride and Prejudice and zombies and like tons and tons and tons of spinoffs. So I agree this is a fresh spin, but I'm almost wondering if you take that inspired by Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice and put it down at the bottom. So we're not leading with that, because again, a lot of agents have assumptions about things. Some agents might be like, oh, another retelling, you know, I'm off retellings or something like that. So I really want people to fall in love with the book and then be like, oh, and, you know, inspired by this, or, you know, just finding a way to weave that in. I just wouldn't lead with it personally. You know, again, that's just my opinion. And I think the other comps, you know, are much stronger: Love Hypothesis and Honey and Spice. Okay, so I think I just want to move some things around here, because, you know, I think it's in the third body paragraph when her failing grade threatens her assistantship, the only way of paying her rent and her GPA, the crucial variable for her admittance into Johns Hopkins. So I think this failing grade bit is just kind of buried a bit at the bottom. Like, we get that her dream is PhD, wants to become a Nobel Prize winner, but I think we kind of just need the stakes to be much more clear. Like, we get the sense that if she fails, then that dream might be in crisis. So can we just move that up a little bit higher? I think, I don't know, in that way, it'll just be really clear about what the stakes are in terms of, you know, her failing and how that feels. And now in terms of the romance, so I always ask with romance, like, what's at stake if they don't work out? And oftentimes in romances or rom-coms, there'll be an act three breakup or a late act two breakup, which they'll kind of like make their way out of and then get back together for the happily ever after. Is there an act three breakup? Is it just more of like a slow burn? I don't know. I just kind of wonder about that. It seems to me maybe a little bit too happily ever after. And again, that's probably just my take here. I think I prefer rom-coms or romances when there isn't an act three breakup, or, you know, that late act two breakup, or that sense of crisis where are they going to get back together, right? Like that sense. Because in romance, the stakes are really the romance, right? And it's like, you know, finding your person and falling in love and all of those like super emotional stakes. And so without that here, I'm kind of just like, oh, they just seem like a nice couple, you know? And that's just, again, for my taste, just isn't enough for a book.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece?
I love the premise. I read the premise and I was like, this sounds like a lot of fun. I'm into it. I was really excited to read the pages. I did wonder a few things, but like, just so you know, this query letter 100% is doing its job, in my opinion. So she mentions that she has a simple dream, right? Like, win the Nobel Prize, get into Johns Hopkins, but we don't find out the field. And I really wanted to know the field. It's, again, not a big deal because I was curious, but it kind of made me wonder, like, is her dream generic? That could be concerning, but like, not a big deal for the query letter. I thought that, like I said, the premise is really sweet. I do think the major dramatic question could be juicier. The line reads, "And as she learns to open her heart, she realizes that the matters of the heart are far more complex than any analytics test." First, you are repeating heart, heart. So I tweak that just on a line level. But I don't know, to Carly's point, I guess, if this were a client sharing a project with me saying, "Cece, this is my second novel I'm working on, is what do you think?" I'd be like, we need to brainstorm ways to up the stakes, up the tension, because it's a really cool premise. Like, I really do want to be very clear about that, but I kind of want it even more. And I wondered almost like, did the sister thread, like, was it forgotten? Because she's so essential to the beginning, kind of like for the contrast. And that also made me wonder, because I do see a lot of authors do this. They'll add a sister for contrast, you know, for family dynamics, and then they'll get into the relationship story, like the romantic relationship, and then they'll forget about the sister relationship. And like, how does that tie into the plot? Because I think that's also important. But you know, like we always say, overall, you're supposed to make me want to read your pages, and you did. So great job.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, what was in those opening pages?
All right, so we start in a classroom setting. We understand that there is an email about the analytics exam, the friends and kind of, you know, sister all talking about it. The class average is really low. So our protagonist is like, you know, am I grouped in with that or did I bring the average up? So a bit of anxiety about the exam, a bit of wondering about, you know, the family dynamics of how the mother feels about that. We learn that she was enrolled in college at 16 and now in graduate school at 20. There is the sister Tenny, who she's kind of communicating with in class. You know, there's a bunch of beauty products that they're talking about and kind of like getting ready for Professor Blake to walk in. They're kind of, again, rehashing the exam itself. And our protagonist is critiquing her sister's obsession with her beauty products. And we find out that Tenny has some sort of interest in a baseball player and is writing him a letter to kind of profess her interest in him. Presumably based on the query letter, this is the baseball player that they're talking about in the query letter. So I feel like we have a little bit of insider knowledge about what's to come here. And then the professor kind of comes in and that's the end.
Okay, Carly, so what did you think of them?
Okay, so I actually really love a chapter title. So this is chapter one, the research question. I don't know. I just feel like it's like a really fun opportunity to stylize it a little bit. So I actually really like chapter one, the research question. I thought that was great. I also really loved the first line. "One major thing I picked up as a Nigerian grad student in America is this. My classmates treat their grades like jollof rice, a Nigerian wedding, significant but hardly the main event." I don't know. I just feel like we learned so much about, you know, her opinion, you know, about school, her Nigerian background. I thought that was a really awesome first line. So I really enjoyed that. I have a couple notes about her like age and the tone. It comes off really young to me. And then later on, we're like, oh, she went to university at 16 and she's in grad school at 20. And I almost wonder if it's like there's a stunted growth thing, if there's like an element of like arrested development in terms of her age. That was kind of flagged for me. I was like, oh, this is reading kind of young to me. So I, again, just wanted to flag that. Another thing that stood out to me was we're talking a lot about other people. We learn about how the other students are feeling about the exam. We learn about her sister. We learn about her mom. And it takes a while to kind of get at herself, you know? She says, "The reason I enrolled in college at 16, the reason I'm now a graduate student at 20. And like, there is a lot of telling about her situation, but not a lot of feeling about her situation other than kind of not wanting to fail this exam. There's a lot of repetition about this exam. The class average was 60. We learned this probably 3 or 4 times. And obviously this is a point of obsession in this scene for our character, but that stood out a little bit to me. And now in terms of the interaction between the sisters, I don't know. I feel like the obsession with the mascara and like getting ready for class in class, like number one is just kind of super unprofessional to show up in class and waiting for the professor and being like, "I'm going to put on my makeup at school." If you care that much about beauty, wouldn't you just get ready before you leave the house, because you're going to encounter all these people on your way to class? So why would you want to put like, I have never understood that. I've seen people putting on makeup in the subway or on the bus or on the streetcar, and I'm like, that's a choice. I don't know. That's just like, if you want to put on makeup that badly, maybe just do that at home. Again, my choice. Another thing she says is, "For someone with such a long list of academic achievements, you're clueless about fashion." So the sister to our protagonist. Actually, this is all about beauty. This is not about fashion. Makeup is beauty, right? Clothes is fashion. So I was like, I don't know. You guys know how I feel about like brands and beauty and like all of this signaling. And I was just like, you just used the wrong word here, which makes me feel like, what is the intention of this scene? Because they're talking about beauty. They're not talking about fashion. Fashion is clothes. Beauty is makeup. Anyway, so I will just flag that. I guess I'm also coming back to, what do we need in this scene to understand the scene? This is what I always think about, right? Because like there's tons of stuff I think that needs to be cut here. I think we talk about the exam too much. And then she talks about how her sister looks. Long, flawless legs, heart-shaped lips, Fanta bottle type of waist, the prettiest round face. She has it all. Do we need to understand how her sister looks to understand this scene? I don't know. I'm very like, I think that can go. So I do think there's quite a bit of trimming that can happen here. And then the idea that she writes a letter. So I wrote Lewis a love letter. Again, I know we're trying to flag the inspiration from Pride and Prejudice, but why not a text? Or why not a different, I don't know, mode of communication? Because I'm just a bit confused about why we're just leaning into that. It just flags a little bit as unrealistic to me. So I was just having a bit of trouble kind of buying that, I guess.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece?
Yeah, I agree with all of Carly's notes. So I guess to jump off that, I guess I'll seg into the makeup comment. They are putting makeup in a classroom. Let us assume that they are fine with this. I do not believe that this protagonist, given her profile, would not be clocking in other student stares. And there isn't a single mention of that. On a personal note, I am going to go with someone who's very close to me, has a medical appointment. I promise to go with her to the hospital. On that same day, I need to look good for something later on. And this person's very good at makeup and I suck. And then she said, I'll bring my makeup. And while we're in the hospital waiting room, I'll put makeup on you because it'll distract me. And I was like, there is no way in hell I'm letting you do that because I will be like dead. Like if everyone's staring at me while that happens. And she's like, no, no, please. It'll really distract me from the thing I have to do. This is all to say, like, even the idea of it made me think of other people looking. And given her background, I don't believe that she's not someone who isn't paying attention to other people looking. I'm not saying she would mind. I'm not saying she would stop her sister because that's just extra steps. But she would at least clock in the stairs. There would be stairs, right? Like people would be staring at her. So yeah, I didn't buy that. Like that to me was not realistic. So I would just calibrate that. It would be more believable for me if her sister were putting makeup on her and she had maybe lost a bet with her sister, because that would explain why it had to happen in the classroom and not back at their own places. You know, like, nope, you promised, you lost the bet. Now I have to put mascara on you. I mean, it would be like, I guess, funnier too. So I don't know. I struggled with that. So I want to go back to the fact that I really like the premise, because I do. Like, it's a fun, wonderful premise. I don't think you're starting in the right place, though. Yes, it's the makeup thing, but it's also the fact that these pages seem to be crafted for the benefit of the reader. Example number one, she mentions how her classmates don't care about grades. And, you know, back in Nigeria, everyone cared about grades. It's framed as though that is the first time she is seeing them not care about grades when she looks at the text messages. And I don't buy that. Her interiority is not having that, oh my God, here we go again, like more of this underachieving nonsense. Do you know what I'm saying? And so like, why would this be noteworthy to her if she's so used to the American students not caring about grades? What I think is happening here is something that I like to call the blank canvas protagonist. And it's a very common mistake. And that's when you have the protagonist reacting to things that are happening, people not caring about grades, her sister putting on makeup, the news about the exam. And nothing in her interiority shares a larger framework. Zooming out to be like, how common this is, how weird this is, what associations you're making. Zooming out is so important. Zooming out is perhaps the most important skill you can develop to make sure that your protagonist's interiority feels authentic, feels real. It doesn't feel like they were just born with these pages. They existed before. I should feel that way. I should feel like this is a real person in the real world. And so I have a whole bunch of notes for you. Like our Substack supporters are going to see like so many notes. And I will say that the more I like something, the more notes I have to offer, because the more the wheels in my brain turn and the more ideas I'm able to come up with, brainstorming is fun. So this is a really good sign, just so you know, like these myriad notes, they're a good, good sign. But I really wanted more. I wanted to dig into her emotionality more, dig into her interiority, really wanted to understand like why these things matter to her. And, you know, it got to a point where I was like, okay, you know what? As much as I like this, maybe I'm trying to make it into something that it's not. Unintentionally, of course. I like interiority heavy novels. I like novels where we're really diving into the psyche of characters. Maybe that's not your novel. you know, and that's okay if it's not. Not every novel has to be my taste. So I will admit to this bias. But for me, there are lines that I highlighted and I'm like, you haven't figured out this character from a psychological point of view. There's a very, very specific line that reads, if her sister were to answer a question in a specific way, quote, I could entertain the childhood fantasy of wanting to be her rather than compete with her, end quote. That makes no psychological sense. Wanting to compete with someone often is wanting to be them. It's linked. It's not a one or the other type of thing. That's what competition is often, especially sisters. So I think you need to figure her out more. I think you need to study more of her specific psychology, which is one of the most fun things to do when you're creating a character. And you have a lot of potential here, a lot of really awesome things. I agree with Carly that the first line is great. So many other great lines too that I highlighted. But I do think you need to go deeper if your vision matches my own, which I do wonder that it might not. And that's okay too, right? Because not every book is for everyone.
Thank you, Cece. Yeah, for this author, go back and listen to our interview with Latoya Watkins. She spoke recently at our deep dive, but we also did an interview with her on method writing and how to really get under a character's skin. And I think there's a lot of insights there that might prove to be useful. I know that there were a lot of takeaways from that that I myself hadn't considered before and that I started putting into place in my own work. Carly and Cece, thank you so much for that. Let's go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. We want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com, look for the beta reader matchup page, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.
Everybody, it's Carly here doing the interview today, and I'm very excited. We have Jo Piazza, who is a best-selling author, podcast creator, award-winning journalist. She is the national and international best-selling author of The Sicilian Inheritance, We Are Not Like Them, You Were Always Mine, Charlotte Walsh Likes to Win, The Knockoff, and How to Be Married. Her work has been published in 10 languages and 12 countries, and 4 of her books have been optioned for film and television. Jo's podcasts have garnered more than 25 million downloads and regularly top podcast charts. An editor, columnist, travel writer, her work has also appeared in Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, New York Magazine, Mary Claire, Glamour, and many other publications. She lives in Philly with her husband, Nick Astor, and 3 feral children. I am very excited about today's guest. So welcome so much to our show, Jo. So tell us, where are you right now?
Well, I am in Sicily right now trying to solve my great-great-grandmother Lorenza's murder. The Sicilian Inheritance is loosely based on her murder. And because I'm a crazy person, I've decided to solve her murder in real life.
And I feel like I saw on socials, you are also turning this into, are you podcasting this as well?
I'm podcasting this. Yeah. It's a full-on true crime podcast. My hands are black because I've been in the basement of the courthouse here in Shaka all morning, digging through 100-year-old court cases. And they're separated by homicide records. And we had to jump through all of these hoops to get them. And then mafia records, which are separate from homicide cases, but also include homicide cases. But the mafia records, and this is just like a funny tidbit, a lot of them are not murders. It is the mafia around here controlled the mules, because mules were cars at the turn of the century, right?
Of course.
So it's a lot of cases of mule thievery that I just went through as I was searching for this murder case. But it's all part of the Sicilian Inheritance podcast. This is a multimedia project at this point.
Well, we can get into your multimedia background. But firstly, I just want to say, I have read so many of your books. And like, there's not a lot of people I have on the show where I'm like, I think I've read almost all your books. I've read The Knockoff. I read Charlotte Walsh. I read We Are Not Like Them, which I chose for our book club, like my book club at home. I read How to Be Married. And obviously, I've read The Sicilian Inheritance. So I feel like I know your whole backstory and your backlist.
You've read the whole Piazza au revoir of both fiction and nonfiction.
I know. And I've listened to your show, and you know, I always DM you when I listen to an episode that I love. And obviously we don't have to get into it here, but you're doing this whole kind of series on trad wives, which I've been following very closely, but obviously we won't dovetail on this show because our show is all about writing and the craft of writing. So I'm really excited to kind of get into this from a craft perspective, as much as obviously just telling you how much I love the book and how I feel like all of our listeners should grab it, because I think this is such an excellent study of doing the dual POV, dual timeline, which is a really tricky thing to pull off. So maybe we'll start there. How did you decide like that was the structure, that was the way you wanted to tell this story?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, I was inspired by the murder of my great-great-grandmother in Sicily, in Caltabolota, the town I'm like right here right now. And I was fascinated by like what happens when a woman is left behind. I knew that I wanted a historical timeline, but I hadn't written historical fiction before. And I think I was a little scared. And so I wanted to do a dual timeline where we had a present day woman. When I feel like my wheelhouse is the present day, I'm like, I can be myself, which is like kind of snarky and sarcastic and like all of the voicey things that usually come out in my writing. And I wanted her to solve this 100-year-old mystery. So that was how I decided to do the dual timeline. I was desperate to write about a woman in 1916, but I think my dual timeline came from a place of fear because I'm so much more comfortable writing in the present. But then both of these women, and this is the most woo-woo thing that I believe, like I am not a religious person. I'm a complete agnostic. I don't believe in God. And yet I believe the characters in novels talk to you and tell you who they want to be and how they want to exist in the world. And the two female protagonists in this, both Sarah and Serafina, just started talking to me. And they became fully fleshed out once I decided to do this dual timeline. And they both had their own distinct voices. And they would talk to me all the time. I mean, it's like, it is literally the like craziest thing that I believe.
I think that all of our listeners will also believe that because I think they think their characters probably talk to them as well. So I think what I'm so curious about from that structure point of view, because again, yeah, once you figured out that was the way you wanted to tell it and it made sense. But what I find so curious from the craft perspective is you want to make obviously each of these chapters relatively the same size in a, like a consumable way. And you want to make sure like the pacing and the structure in each of these timelines makes sense. So how did you map all of that out?
So I do not outline. I am like, I think the 5%, Actually, El Casamano, who does the Finley Donovan series, we were in conversation the other day, and she was like, you're either a planner or a pantser, meaning you fly by the seat of your pants. And I'd never heard that before, and I love it. I'm like, I'm just a pantser. I'm such a pantser. I sit down and I write 2,000 words every single day, and I fly by the seat of my pants, and I don't know what's going to happen next. So, and I know with dual timelines, that's like really hard, because you kind of have to know, like, how are these chapters going to intertwine with each other? Like, how are things going to come about? I don't think about it in the first draft. I just write it all in the first draft. And that is essentially my outline. Like, my outline comes from this shitty first draft that I just let myself do. And then I'll go back and make sure that they correspond with each other, that you're getting the same emotional arc after I've done the whole book, right? But also after I've done that first draft, then I read each character's section as if it's its own book. So I don't go back and forth during that first reread. I read Sarah's present day timeline as one book, and then I read Serafina's timeline in the historical narrative as one book, to make sure that if they were their own books, they completely hold up. They completely make sense. And then I do my next read where I put them on top of each other.
Yeah, I love that. And the way that I read it was that these could have been two separate stories, but the whole point was that obviously they build together to the big mystery. Right. Yeah, and it all came together. So let's talk a little bit about, because you said a little bit, maybe like you're nervous writing historical, because obviously like your background was more writing contemporary. I think like some of my favorite historical books are ones where we know it's historical, obviously, like it's set in the past, but there's so many like current themes and modern themes that we can use as kind of a mirror to our current society. And can you talk a little bit about how you did that, about like women's rights and things like that in this book?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, my writing has been at first glance kind of all over the place, much to my agent's chagrin, by the way, and a lot of editors' chagrin. They're like, why can't you just do one thing all the time? We love it when people stay in their lane. And I'm like, but I'm fascinated by all of these different things. But if there's one through line through all of it, I do think that it is telling women's stories that haven't been told before, and stories about women's agency and women's empowerment. It would be amazing if there were a section of the bookstore or a genre for that, but there is not, alas. And so as I started writing this, and you know, I'm writing about a woman in the early 20th century in Sicily. A million men left Sicily between the late 1890s and 1910. A million. So many women were left alone. And when I did my research, I found out that it was kind of a feminist period in Sicilian history, because they took over a lot of the men's jobs because there were no men in the towns. And for the first time, they got very educated. Many of them learned to read for the first time, to do accounting for the first time, to buy and sell land for the first time. And so it became this very empowering narrative of, you know, women helping other women, women overcoming even in the face of their rights being eroded. And I was writing this from about 2019 until today, as we watched our rights being eroded more and more here in the States. And those two, the two timelines, the themes just started to really, you know, intertwine in terms of how do we talk about women's ambition? How do we allow women to be ambitious in the world? And I think one of the big through lines in the book that you see happen over generations is that we haven't come as far as we think we have, and that there is still so much more work to do for women to be able to become their best selves and live their best lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And it made me think of Charlotte Walsh, one of your other books about like women and ambition. It's one of my favorite themes to read about, because I just feel like there is no bottom to that well. It's just limitless in terms of what I could consume in that content. So I love that you keep writing about it.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's really important to write about it in different ways and different genres too, right? Mm-hmm. So I love the historical fiction that I love is mostly about women overcoming the odds and women's ambition. I read a lot of Pam Jenoff. She's really great with that. But I think that way you get to touch so many different readers who want to pick up a different genre. And fiction, I think fiction, even more than nonfiction, genuinely has the ability to change hearts and minds because it touches you in a different way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I also want to talk about, and I'm just curious about your opinion, about what a book club book is. Because I feel like this is the perfect book club book, because my definition of book club is a book that people can talk about? Because I think a lot of people write books and they're like, I think my book is for book clubs. And like, what does that mean when somebody says their book is a book club book? And I'm just curious, because I'm sure you've attended lots of book clubs over the years. Obviously, the books you've co-written with Christine are great book club books. Well, how do you define a book club book? And how do you think about that?
I've been to so many other people's book clubs. For We Are Not Like Them, that I co-wrote with Christine, we zoomed into more than 300 book clubs over the past few years, which has been amazing. Like, I've been invited into people's living rooms. I've watched them talk about books. It is such an honor and a privilege to be able to do that. And so I have a definition of a book club book. And I think that it is a book that gives you something to think about and talk about and also to disagree about. I like a book club book that is going to start hard conversations. And we did that with We Are Not Like Them with race. And now with The Sicilian Inheritance, there's a lot of questions of right and wrong and morality and ethics in this book that I think people are going to be on different sides of. And the best discussions for me are the ones that spark conversations and spark some disagreements. And I think The Sicilian Inheritance is really going to do that for book clubs.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I also think about, because like you said, right, you're zooming into people's living rooms, right? It's like their neighbors are there, their mother-in-law, their sister. It's like the way that book clubs come together and that mostly women come together in book clubs and want to have these deep discussions and want to have a launching pad to have these deeper discussions. That's what book club books are about. So I'm glad we're in agreement on what a book club book is.
We are. I will tell you. So I'm planning on doing a lot of zooming in for The Sicilian Inheritance for book clubs. I'm booking them now. But as a bonus for people, I'm going to show them how to make a good cannoli when I zoom into their book club and be like, okay, we can talk about the book, but also we're going to make some cannoli while we do this.
I love this. Well, I got to get you back for my next book club as well, because we could definitely use some cannoli. This is incredible. All right. So let's talk a little bit about how you weave in any sort of personal elements into your writing, because obviously, you know, you've written their book about marriage, which is like, that's one of the most intimate things you can talk about. You also have this family history kind of jumping off point for The Sicilian Inheritance. Do you want to talk about how you think about, or when you think it is the time to kind of weave in personal life into fiction and nonfiction?
Yeah, I mean, it is so funny because sometimes I don't even realize that I'm doing it, that I'm weaving in actual details, not just from my own life, but my friends' lives. My best friend is here in Sicily with me. She decided to join me on this reporting trip because she had time before her kids' spring break and she was off. And she's reading Sicilian Inheritance for the first time here in Sicily. And I have a line about this woman who's learning to drive a Mustang convertible and has to learn stick because of it. And that was my best friend's 16-year-old car. And she's like, did you like, and I was like, oh yeah, no, that was you. That was you. Yeah.
I've been logging all of this for decades.
Yeah, I'm like something, I had completely forgotten it. You know, I think that as authors, we do weave a lot of personal experiences and stories. My family has been telling the story of this family murder for so long. It's been a 100-year game of telephone, and they all have a different version of it because we are Italian American and we are liars and we are storytellers and myth makers. And so they all tell like this different kind of story. And they also don't really understand what a novel is. So when they pick it up, they're like, oh, this is me. And I'm like, no, it's fiction. I made this up. And they're like, oh no, but that's, you know, Uncle Jimmy. And I'm like, it's really not. It is a novel. It is completely, but there are definitely elements of my family that I've woven into the different characters. And especially Sarah Marsala's dad, he definitely has attributes of my own father who loved this story so much. And he really wanted to try to solve this mystery himself. And he came over here a bunch of times to do that. And so part of writing this book, I think, was, and he passed 7 years ago, part of writing this book was my way to connect with him and to also mourn him in a way, because I didn't really do that when he passed away 7 years ago.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Oh, I appreciate that sentiment so much. And you're right. You probably don't know when you're weaving in real life versus fiction. You're like, it's all just blending together in my imagination.
It literally all blends together in my head. And it takes like one of my friends or my husband to read something and they're like, excuse me.
I love that. I have a question about how you think of yourself as a storyteller and an entertainer, because I think one of the things that I really respect about your career is that you are jumping around, right? You're like, I'm going to do this podcasting thing. I'm going to write fiction. I'm going to write nonfiction. And obviously you have your journalism background and you write books that are, I think, really smart and really entertaining. And so do you think of yourself as an entertainer? Like how, I'm just so curious about how you perceive yourself as like creating content and media.
Yeah. I mean, if someone were to ask me, and when someone does ask me, like, what do you do? I now typically say storyteller because I do create in so many different mediums and mainly podcasting and novels these days. But I think that, you know, I'm constantly trying to find ways to tell different stories in the best medium possible. And so I do think of myself as a storyteller and also an entertainer because I want to captivate people and I want to entertain people. And we live in such a strange time in media and publishing. There is a lot that AI is going to be able to replace. It is not going to be able to replace the creation of these kinds of stories or the people that can genuinely entertain you. And so I'm always, as media pivots for the past 20 years, I've been trying to find out how can I continue to do what I love, which is sharing stories with people in whatever new medium is coming. And, you know, I even feel like I do that on social media now. I'm like, how can I give people stories and information in these snippets on social, in this long form, in audio, on podcasts, and then in a book, which is a totally different way of consuming the content.
Yeah, no, I think it's super smart. And I agree with you. I was actually recording a podcast about AI and storytelling yesterday for somebody else's show. And I completely agree with you. I'm like, there is nothing going to be more important moving forward than people who can tell the story, right? Because that's what we do in terms of podcasting, in terms of book writing, essays, social media, YouTube, you know, whatever you want to create, right? Like, that's what's going to grab people's attention and ultimately move the conversation forward for whatever topic that you want to be able to communicate on, yeah. Which again, like what you're trying to do, obviously through, you know, the women's rights and everything through this great novel. And I'm keep looking down because like I have it right beside me. I'm like, this
book. Right there.
Yes. So for anybody who is thinking about weaving some kind of family story or family lore into their book, do you have any advice for people who might want to be doing something like that?
Oh my gosh, my best advice that I can give about this, and you're the first person to ask, and I'm so glad I get to share it, is if you have a nugget of family lore that you want to explore in fiction, not nonfiction, I say use that nugget, but then write the story or write the book without doing the research or reporting into the real story. If you genuinely want to write fiction, then I think you have to let the fiction lead the way. I did not do research into this actual murder of my great-great-grandmother until after I had finished the book, because I didn't want the real story to kind of get in the way of me developing these characters and the magic that happens in the fiction. The crazy woo-woo thing is that after I wrote the book and I started reporting the real story, a lot of what I had written was true. And so in a lot of ways, I'm like, wow, I mean, I do feel like my great-great-grandmother was informing this story. But if you want to write fiction, then write fiction. If you want to write nonfiction, do all the research. But I think you have to make that choice early on, or you blur the lines in kind of a strange way.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to jump over to another form of medium, which is you have sold TV and film rights for a number of your books. What is your relationship like in terms of, do you like being involved in the process in terms of adaptation? Mm-hmm. Are you somebody who's like, please go off and run with this and make that your own project? How do you feel about that?
So I have sold the rights to almost all of my books, most of them, and most of them are still active in one way or another. I want to be very, very involved. I will tell you that in many cases, Hollywood does not want you involved, and they will do the best they can to give you like a faux title, like consulting producer, to get you out of the way. So that happened very early on in my writing with the first few options. And then I kind of got wise to it. And now I don't negotiate an option unless I'm going to get executive producer and a writing credit and hopefully maybe even a co-showrunner on it. I didn't know that when I was first negotiating anything. So I was definitely pushed off to the side with my first big option and production project. But now I want to be involved. I want more control. I am a writer. And so, of course, I want to like be involved in the adaptation to the screen. And for Sicilian Inheritance, we're actually in talks with a really great showrunner right now who I would love to collaborate with. And for We Are Not Like Them, Christine Pride and I, we have a wonderful showrunner, but we're the ones writing the pilot pitch and ultimately writing the pilot.
Great. I love that. I can't wait to see some of this stuff come to life. Has anything been made? Did I miss it?
No, God, nothing has been made because—
things take forever. Yeah.
Well, one, they take forever. And two, I don't know how anything gets made in Hollywood with all of the hoops that you have to jump through. It's insane. Okay. Like, I think that the publishing process is kind of crazy sometimes, but the process of a television show getting made, I'm like, it just is like fairy dust and clicking your heels is what it is. And for Charlotte Walsh, we had the writer's room. We had all 8 scripts written. We were about to go into production. And our lead had a dream that told her not to do it and backed out. So like, you just like, anything can happen.
And anything does happen. I think about that all the time. Like I've sold, I think for, you know, various clients over the years, probably like 14 TV film options. And I'm like, it is wild to think that only one of those things has actually ever made it to the screen and how long it takes and quality, right? Because you're just like, so many people have to be in there. There's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, a lot of opinions about whatever gets made. And so I agree, like if you are somebody who does want control of this and you do want to see it through to a certain way and you have a certain vision, being involved is kind of the only way, right? But some people are like, want to sell it and leave. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny too, because I had my team at UTA was asking me, they're like, who's your dream actress for The Sicilian Inheritance? And I was like, the one who gets it made, guys. Go find the actress who will just make it happen.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm thinking right now, I've been following Dakota Johnson's press tour for Madame Web, and I'm like, I feel like she would be great for this, but also she creates so much buzz when she does press tours that I would just love that for you.
I would love that for me. I would love that. I love the idea. I love Lizzie Kaplan so much. Mm-hmm. And I'm like aggressively trying to get this yeah. work to Lizzie Kaplan. So I just say it all the time because I'm like, hey, Lizzie, if you're listening, call us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She will hear this. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for all of this. You know, as I said, this is a show that is dedicated to writers. Do you have any kind of like wisdom, parting words, anything for all the writers who are emerging and aspiring out there?
Yeah. I mean, I do think... my advice is different now than it was even a year ago. I think the publishing world is trying to figure out what it is all about right now. Writers have to work harder than ever to get their stories out there. And then even when it becomes a book, to sell those books. I mean, I have become a massive world-class hustler for The Sicilian Inheritance. I'm doing some strange things for this book. We printed out all of these flyers that I put on the back doors of bathrooms and bars because you have a captive audience. I mean, I'm doing guerrilla marketing for this book. And so, you know, my advice for writers who are coming up is to, you know, think about, and it's terrible to have to say, because you just want to write a book and you want it to be, you know, your art, but like, you have to think about how to sell it from day one. Yeah. And how to sell it to the publishers and how to sell it to readers. And because the reality is that that is as much a part, if not more, of the process these days than actually writing the book. If you want your story to reach as many people as you really want it to reach.
Incredible. Well, everybody listening, I didn't tell Joe to say that. That is exactly what I would have said. But we are on the same page about that. Publishing is figuring itself out, which is hard when you're in it, right? And being an author, like I've been in publishing long enough. Like I remember when BNN wasn't stocking SNS titles. And it's like, there's just so much that's like out of author's control where you're like, all I want to do is write like the very best book possible. And then there's just so much that we can control, whether it's distribution or mergers or acquisitions or your editors mm-hmm. leaving. Right. And you know, you are the best champion for your book because you know, your name's on the cover. So I agree. All right, Joe. Well, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Everybody go get their copy of The Sicilian Inheritance. I totally recommend it, especially if you're writing historical, especially if you're writing dual POV and or dual timeline. This is a really, really great case study for you. So thank you, Joe.
Thank you. I'm going to go drive up to this village now. I need some more cannoli.
Sounds great. Ship some home.
Bye.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.